A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a good one. He's been thinking about polypharmacy, the whole business of taking multiple medications. He describes how it took him 3 circuitous years to accept he needed both an ADHD med and an SSRI, not just one. He'd try one, then the other, before finally giving in to the combination. Same pattern with asthma. Stretches of probably suboptimal care because he didn't want to add Singulair on top of his inhaler. And he's traced this resistance back to some interesting places. Growing up in Ireland, where doctor visits weren't free and medications were a genuine financial burden on the family, so you learn to see pills as a last resort. There's also this deeper unease. The idea that if you were dropped into a random part of the world, you couldn't survive without a complex set of pills being delivered to your body. It feels like it erodes spontaneity. And then there's the straightforward worry about whether the body can really handle being on 5 or 6 pills daily. He's now at 7. Relvar, allopurinol, Singulair, Lexapro, Vyvanse, omeprazole, and a blood pressure med. And he's asking us to give him some counter perspective to his own internal narrative. Where do we even start with this?
I want to start with the body can't handle it question, because that's actually the most straightforward to address, and I think it's the one where the science offers the clearest rebuttal. The short answer is that the human body handles multiple medications constantly, all the time, and has been doing so for decades. The concern isn't irrational, it's just that the thing people worry about and the thing doctors worry about are almost completely different. When someone says, "Can my body handle 7 medications?" they're usually imagining some kind of cumulative load, like the liver and kidneys are buckets that eventually overflow. That's not how it works. Your body doesn't process medications as a single, undifferentiated pile of chemicals. Each drug has its own metabolic pathway, its own receptor targets, its own clearance mechanism. The liver has entire families of enzymes. The cytochrome P450 system, for instance, and different drugs use different ones. It's more like an airport with 50 gates than a single runway. The real concern with polypharmacy isn't some vague total load. It's specific drug-drug interactions. Does drug A change how drug B is metabolized? Does drug C amplify drug D's effect? Those are specific, knowable, and largely avoidable problems.
The bucket metaphor is wrong, but the traffic controller metaphor is right.
And traffic controllers have manuals. They're called drug interaction databases, and they're built into every prescribing system these days. It's not like the old days where a physician was working off memory in a pocket reference.
Let me push on that a little, because I think part of what's behind the prompt is a distrust of the system itself. The feeling that doctors are just adding pills without fully thinking through the whole picture.
That's a fair concern, and it does happen. But here's what's interesting. The real danger zone for polypharmacy isn't a 37-year-old on 7 carefully indicated medications. It's the 80-year-old on 15 medications prescribed by 4 different specialists who don't talk to each other. That's where you get prescribing cascades. Drug A causes a side effect, which gets treated with drug B, which causes another side effect, which gets treated with drug C. That's a genuine problem, and geriatric medicine has been wrestling with it for years. But that's not the situation described in the prompt. These are 7 medications for distinct diagnosed conditions, each with a clear therapeutic purpose.
Walk me through the list. Relvar, allopurinol, Singulair, Lexapro, Vyvanse, omeprazole, Vector Plus. As a former pediatrician, if a patient came to you with that list, what would you actually be looking for?
First thing I'd note is there's almost no overlap in mechanism. Relvar is an inhaled corticosteroid plus a long-acting beta agonist. It works locally in the lungs. Singulair is a leukotriene receptor antagonist, completely different pathway, also for asthma, but oral. Allopurinol reduces uric acid production for gout. Lexapro is an SSRI, Vyvanse is a prodrug stimulant for ADHD. Omeprazole is a proton pump inhibitor for acid reflux. Vector Plus, I assume, is an ACE inhibitor or ARB for blood pressure. I'm not familiar with that specific brand name. It might be an Israeli formulation. The point is, these are hitting entirely different systems. They're not piling onto the same receptor. They're not competing for the same metabolic enzyme in any major way.
The body isn't being asked to do the same thing 7 times. It's being asked to do 7 different things, and it's perfectly capable of doing many things simultaneously.
Think about what your body is already doing without any medications. It's regulating blood pressure, managing inflammatory responses, producing neurotransmitters, controlling acid secretion, metabolizing purines into uric acid, and then excreting them. It's running hundreds of biochemical pathways in parallel. Medications don't add entirely new processes. They modulate existing ones. Allopurinol doesn't create a new function in your body. It just inhibits xanthine oxidase, an enzyme you already have to reduce uric acid production. Your body was already running that enzyme. The medication just turns down the dial.
That's actually a helpful reframe. The medications aren't foreign invaders. They're more like dimmer switches on circuits that are already there.
And some of these medications are essentially replacing something your body should be doing but isn't, or modulating something it's doing too much of. The Lexapro is adjusting serotonin reuptake, a process that's already happening, just not optimally. The Omeprazole is reducing stomach acid secretion. Your body already regulates that, it's just overproducing. None of this is alien biochemistry.
Let's talk about the financial and cultural layer, because I think that's actually the deepest part of what's described in the prompt. The idea that you grow up in a system where medications are a burden, where you learn to minimize doctor visits, where pills feel like a last resort, that doesn't just vanish when you move to a country with better healthcare.
It really doesn't. There's actually a body of research on this. It's called Health Beliefs and Medication Adherence, and early experiences with healthcare systems shape it profoundly. If you learned as a child that going to the doctor meant your parents worrying about money, that gets encoded at a level that rational argument doesn't easily reach. You can know intellectually that your medications are now affordable and necessary and still feel a visceral resistance to taking them.
I think there's also something about masculinity here that doesn't get discussed enough. The idea that needing things, needing pills, needing help, needing maintenance, is somehow a failure. That a properly functioning human should be self-sufficient.
And it's nonsense, obviously, but it's culturally potent nonsense. Nobody thinks a diabetic is morally failing by taking insulin. Nobody thinks someone with a broken leg should just walk it off. But when the conditions are invisible, mental health, blood pressure, asthma management, suddenly there's this idea that maybe you could tough it out.
The prompt mentions the spontaneity thing. The unsettling feeling that if you were dropped into a random part of the world, you couldn't survive without your pills. That one hit me, actually.
And I think it's worth sitting with that feeling and asking what it's really about. Because if you were dropped into a random part of the world, you'd also need glasses. If you wear them, you'd need your specific diet. If you have food sensitivities, you'd need shelter from the elements. The medications are just one item on a long list of things that maintain your functioning. We don't feel existentially threatened by needing food and water every day. We don't feel like our spontaneity is eroded by needing sleep. These are just maintenance requirements of being a biological organism.
There's a difference, though. Food and water and sleep are universal. Everyone needs them. Medications feel individual, and therefore somehow optional or weak.
That's the stigma talking, not the biology. And I think this is where the prompt's self-awareness is really striking. The acknowledgement that these objections aren't well-grounded, but they're powerful anyway. That's the thing about internal narratives. They don't need to be true to be effective.
Let's get into the actual clinical picture of polypharmacy, because I think there's a counter-narrative that's worth laying out explicitly. What does the evidence actually say about quality of life for people on multiple medications for chronic conditions?
This is where the story gets genuinely interesting. There's a concept in medicine called appropriate polypharmacy versus inappropriate polypharmacy. Inappropriate polypharmacy is what I mentioned earlier. The prescribing cascade, the multiple medications with overlapping effects, the drugs that are continued past their useful window. That's bad, and it's associated with worse outcomes. But appropriate polypharmacy, multiple medications, each addressing a specific diagnosed condition with clear therapeutic goals, that's associated with better outcomes. People live longer, function better, and have fewer acute episodes when their chronic conditions are properly managed.
The distinction isn't between few medications and many medications. It's between well-managed and poorly managed.
And for many conditions, the standard of care is actually combination therapy from the start. Asthma is a perfect example. The Global Initiative for Asthma Guidelines recommend combination therapy, an inhaled corticosteroid plus a long-acting bronchodilator, as the preferred treatment for anyone with moderate or severe persistent asthma. It's not a failure to need both. It's the standard of care. The evidence shows that combination therapy reduces exacerbations, improves lung function, and reduces the need for rescue inhalers compared to either drug alone.
The prompt's instinct to avoid adding Singulair on top of the inhaler is actually working against the best available evidence.
And I understand why. There's something psychologically appealing about monotherapy, the idea that one pill or one inhaler should be enough. But that's an aesthetic preference, not a medical principle. The body doesn't care about elegance. It cares about whether the pathways are being adequately modulated.
The body doesn't care about elegance. That's going to stick with me.
Let me give you another example from the list. Allopurinol for gout. Gout is caused by uric acid crystals forming in joints. It's exquisitely painful. Allopurinol reduces uric acid production. If you don't take it, you get gout attacks. These aren't mild inconveniences. A full-blown gout attack in the big toe is one of the most painful things a person can experience. Patients describe it as feeling like the joint is being crushed in a vise while being burned. And here's the thing. Gout isn't just about pain. Recurrent gout causes permanent joint damage. It's associated with kidney stones, with kidney damage, with increased cardiovascular risk. Taking allopurinol isn't a luxury or a crutch. It's preventing cumulative, irreversible harm.
The same logic applies to the blood pressure medication, I assume.
Even more so. Hypertension is famously asymptomatic. It's called the silent killer for a reason. You don't feel your blood pressure being high. But over years and decades, it damages your arteries, your heart, your kidneys, your brain. It dramatically increases your risk of stroke, heart attack, and kidney failure. Taking a blood pressure medication isn't about how you feel today. It's about whether you have a stroke at 55. That's a hard thing to feel emotionally connected to because the benefit is invisible. It's a disaster that didn't happen.
This gets at something important about the psychology here. The costs of taking medication are immediate and tangible. The daily routine, the refills, the sense of dependence, the mild side effects. The benefits are often invisible and probabilistic. You don't feel your blood pressure being controlled. You don't feel your uric acid levels dropping. You just don't have a stroke, or don't have a gout attack, or don't have an asthma exacerbation. The medication is working precisely when nothing happens.
That's brilliantly put. And it creates a perverse incentive. When the medication is working perfectly, you feel normal, and then you start wondering why you're taking it. You feel fine. Maybe you don't need it after all. This is one of the major reasons for medication non-adherence across every condition. People stop taking their statins because they feel fine. They stop taking their blood pressure meds because they feel fine. They're feeling fine because the medication is working.
The internal narrative that says, maybe I could live without this one, is being fed by the medication's own success.
It's a self-defeating loop, and breaking out of it requires a kind of trust in counterfactuals. Trust that the reason you're not experiencing symptoms is because of the medication, not in spite of it.
Let's talk about the ADHD and depression combination specifically, because the prompt describes a 3-year journey to accepting that combination, and I think that's incredibly common.
It's extremely common, and it speaks to something that doesn't get discussed enough in mental health treatment. The idea that combination therapy is somehow a failure of finding the right single drug. There's this cultural narrative, even among some clinicians, that the goal is to find the one medication that fixes everything. If you need two, it means the first one wasn't quite right, or the diagnosis was incomplete. That's not how neurobiology works.
Walk me through why.
ADHD and depression involve different neurotransmitter systems, different brain circuits, different pathologies. ADHD is primarily about dopamine and norepinephrine dysregulation in the prefrontal cortex. Depression involves serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine systems, but in different circuits and with different patterns. An SSRI like Lexapro primarily affects serotonin. A stimulant like Vyvanse primarily affects dopamine and norepinephrine. They're not redundant. They're not competing. They're addressing different aspects of brain function that happen to both be impaired.
Treating ADHD and depression with a single medication would be like trying to fix both a leaky pipe and a broken window with the same tool.
You might get lucky and find a medication that helps both somewhat. Bupropion, for instance, has some evidence for both depression and ADHD, but it's generally less effective for each condition than the targeted treatments. The combination of an SSRI and a stimulant isn't a failure of monotherapy. It's two different conditions requiring two different approaches.
The 3-year delay the prompt describes. That's 3 years of suboptimal functioning, 3 years of unnecessary suffering, because of an aesthetic preference for one pill instead of two.
That's the tragedy of it. And I see this pattern constantly. People will struggle for years with partial treatment, cycling through different monotherapies, never quite getting better because they're resistant to the idea of combination treatment. Meanwhile, the evidence for combination therapy and treatment-resistant depression is robust. The STAR-D trial, the largest study of depression treatment ever conducted, showed that for people who don't respond fully to a single antidepressant, adding a second agent is often more effective than switching to a different single agent. The cumulative remission rate across all treatment steps was around 67%. The takeaway isn't that most people need one pill, it's that many people need more than one, and persisting through multiple strategies pays off.
The evidence says, keep going, try combinations, the odds are in your favor. The internal narrative says, one pill should be enough, needing two means you failed.
The internal narrative is empirically wrong, not just emotionally unhelpful, factually incorrect.
Let's address the refill and expiration anxiety, because I think that's a practical concern that gets dismissed too easily.
It's not trivial. Managing 7 medications means tracking 7 different refill schedules, 7 different expiration dates, possibly 7 different pharmacies or prescribing physicians. It's administrative overhead on top of the medical condition itself, and in systems where medications require monthly prescriptions with limited repeats, it can feel like a part-time job.
There's also the travel problem. The prompt mentions being plopped into a random part of the world and not being able to survive. If you're on 7 medications, international travel does require planning. You need enough supply, you need documentation, you need to know whether your medications are legal at your destination.
And I don't want to minimize that, but I do want to reframe it slightly. The administrative burden is real, but it's also solvable in ways that the underlying medical conditions are not. You can set up automatic refills. You can use pill organizers. You can work with a pharmacist to synchronize your refill dates. Many pharmacies offer this as a service called medication synchronization or MedSync. You can get 90-day supplies instead of 30-day supplies for maintenance medications. These are solvable logistics problems. The alternative, not treating the conditions, isn't a logistics problem. It's a health catastrophe waiting to happen.
That's the trade-off, isn't it? Some administrative hassle versus the certainty of disease progression.
And I think when you frame it that way, the hassle looks a lot more tolerable. Nobody loves refilling prescriptions. Nobody loves packing a pharmacy bag for a 2-week trip. But compared to a gout attack while you're on vacation, or an asthma exacerbation because you skipped your controller medication, or a depressive episode because you decided to taper off your SSRI, the administrative burden is trivial.
There's a line in the prompt about feeling like medications erode natural spontaneity. I want to push on that a bit because I think it's connected to a broader cultural idea about authenticity and the natural self.
This is a deep one. The idea that there's a natural state that's more authentic than a medicated state, that the real you is the unmedicated you. I think this is philosophically incoherent, but I understand why it feels compelling. Because there's no privileged baseline. Your natural state with untreated ADHD isn't more authentic than your treated state. It's just one configuration of your neurochemistry. If you had poor eyesight, your natural state would be blurry vision, but nobody thinks glasses make you less authentic. If you had diabetes, your natural state would involve dangerously high blood sugar, but nobody thinks insulin erodes your true self. The idea that brain chemistry is somehow different, that modifying it changes who you really are, is Cartesian dualism dressed up as wellness culture. It assumes the mind is separate from the brain, and that altering the brain's chemistry somehow contaminates the mind's authenticity.
Whereas you'd say the mind is what the brain does, and a brain that's functioning better produces a mind that's more capable of being itself.
The unmedicated ADHD brain isn't a purer expression of the self. It's a brain that's struggling to do what it wants to do. The medication doesn't impose a foreign identity. It removes an obstacle to the expression of the identity that's already there. People with ADHD don't become different. People on stimulants. They become more capable of being the people they already are.
That's a lovely way to put it. The medication doesn't add a self. It clears a path.
I think this connects to the spontaneity concern. The fear is that being on medications makes you less free, tied to a schedule, dependent on a system, unable to just pick up and go. But what's the alternative? Being unmedicated and unable to function well enough to be spontaneous anyway? Severe untreated ADHD doesn't make you spontaneous. It makes you stuck. Untreated depression doesn't make you free. It makes you unable to get out of bed.
The spontaneity that the medication supposedly costs you wasn't really available to begin with.
The medications don't trade freedom for constraint. They trade one kind of constraint, the constraint of the untreated condition, for a different, much milder constraint, the constraint of taking pills on a schedule. And the second constraint actually enables more genuine freedom than the first.
Let's get concrete about the 7 medication list. I want to go through it systematically and ask, what would happen if each one were removed? What's the counterfactual?
Let's do it. Relvar, that's the daily asthma inhaler. Stop that, and you're looking at poorly controlled airway inflammation. Increased reliance on rescue inhalers. Higher risk of severe exacerbations that could land you in the emergency department. Over time, airway remodeling. Permanent changes to the lung structure that reduce lung function irreversibly. Asthma kills people. About 10 Americans die from asthma every day. It's not a trivial condition. Stop allopurinol, uric acid levels rise, gout attacks resume. And not just acute attacks, chronic tophaceous gout, where uric acid crystals form visible deposits in joints and soft tissues. Increased cardiovascular risk. Gout is associated with a roughly 50% increased risk of cardiovascular mortality. It's not just about toe pain. Singulair addresses a different pathway than the inhaled corticosteroid. It blocks leukotrienes, inflammatory mediators involved in asthma and allergic responses. Some people get significant additional benefit from adding it. Without it, you might have more breakthrough symptoms, especially exercise-induced or allergy-triggered asthma. It might not be as immediately catastrophic as stopping the Relvar, but you'd likely have worse day-to-day control. Stop the SSRI, and the depression returns. Not immediately, there's a washout period, but within weeks to months, the symptoms that led to the prescription in the first place come back, and recurrent depressive episodes tend to become more frequent and more severe over time. The kindling hypothesis suggests that each episode makes the brain more vulnerable to future episodes. Staying on maintenance treatment isn't just about preventing the next episode, it's about altering the long-term trajectory of the illness. Stop the stimulant, ADHD symptoms return. Executive dysfunction, difficulty with focus and organization, impulsivity. For someone whose work and daily functioning depend on being able to sustain attention and manage complex tasks, this isn't a minor inconvenience. Untreated ADHD is associated with lower educational attainment, lower income, higher rates of accidents, higher rates of substance use disorders. It's a condition with real functional consequences. Stop the proton pump inhibitor, and if you have gastroesophageal reflux disease, the acid reflux comes back. Chronic untreated GERD isn't just heartburn. It can lead to esophageal inflammation, strictures, Barrett's esophagus, which is a precancerous condition, and esophageal adenocarcinoma. Again, a condition that seems minor, heartburn, has potentially serious long-term consequences.
Vector Plus for blood pressure.
Stop the antihypertensive blood pressure rises, and then nothing happens for years. That's the insidious thing about hypertension. You feel fine. Meanwhile, your arteries are being damaged. Your heart is working harder and gradually enlarging. Your kidneys are being silently injured. And then one day you have a stroke or a heart attack or kidney failure. The time between stopping the medication and the catastrophe can be years, which makes it psychologically very easy to stop. The causality is so delayed that people don't connect the dots.
Across all 7, the pattern is the same. Stopping the medication doesn't return you to health. It returns you to untreated disease. And for most of these, the untreated disease involves cumulative, often irreversible damage.
That's the key insight. The medications aren't optional enhancements. They're not performance boosters. They're preventing disease progression. The baseline isn't healthy person who happens to take pills. The baseline is person with multiple chronic conditions who stays healthy because the pills are managing those conditions.
That reframe alone might be worth the price of admission. You're not a healthy person taking medications. You're a person with several conditions who is healthy because you're adequately treated.
That's not a failure of character. It's not a sign of weakness. It's just the hand you were dealt, biologically speaking, plus the tools that modern medicine has developed to let you play that hand effectively.
I want to circle back to something the prompt mentions. The idea that growing up in a system where healthcare was expensive created a lasting instinct to minimize treatment. I think this is a much bigger phenomenon than people realize. It's a form of medical trauma, honestly.
It absolutely is, and it's not just an Irish phenomenon. People who grew up without good insurance, or in families where medical bills were a source of stress, or in cultures where stoicism about health was a virtue, they carry that into adulthood even when their circumstances change. You see it in people who delay going to the doctor for symptoms that clearly need attention. You see it in people who try to taper themselves off medications without telling their physician. You see it in people who feel guilty every time they fill a prescription.
That's the word, isn't it? There's a moral dimension to this. Taking medication feels like a kind of moral failing. You should have been stronger. You should have tried harder. You should have been able to fix this yourself.
That moral framing is completely disconnected from the biology. Nobody thinks a type 1 diabetic has a moral obligation to produce their own insulin. Nobody thinks someone with hypothyroidism should just try harder to make their thyroid work. But when the condition is mental health, or when it's an invisible chronic condition that could theoretically be influenced by lifestyle, suddenly there's this moral overlay. You should be able to manage your blood pressure with diet and exercise. You should be able to overcome depression with therapy and positive thinking. You should be able to focus without stimulants if you just try harder.
The thing is, lifestyle does matter. Diet and exercise do affect blood pressure. Therapy does help depression. Behavioral strategies do help ADHD. But for many people, they're not sufficient. The idea that you have to exhaust all non-pharmacological options before medication becomes acceptable is a recipe for unnecessary suffering.
It's the last resort framing that the prompt mentions. Medications is something you turn to only when everything else has failed. If we know a medication is effective and safe, why should someone have to fail at diet and exercise for 6 months before they're allowed to take a blood pressure pill that will prevent their arteries from being damaged during those 6 months? The hierarchy is based on moral intuition, not medical evidence.
There's also an irony here that I think is worth pointing out. The same culture that makes people feel guilty about taking medications often has no problem with supplements, nootropics, herbal remedies, biohacking, cold plunges, whatever wellness trend is circulating. People will spend hundreds of dollars on unregulated supplements with no evidence base, but feel guilty about taking a generic SSRI that costs $10 a month and has been studied in hundreds of thousands of patients.
The supplement industry is a $150 billion global market built largely on the idea that natural equals safe and effective, while pharmaceutical equals dangerous and artificial. It's a marketing triumph and a public health disaster. Supplements are essentially unregulated in the United States. The FDA doesn't review them for safety or efficacy before they hit the market. They can contain contaminants, different doses than labeled, even actual prescription drugs. And yet people feel morally superior taking them because they're natural.
As opposed to the unnatural chemicals produced by nature in laboratories built by humans who are also nature.
The naturalistic fallacy is a powerful thing, and the pharmaceutical industry has its own problems. I'm not here to defend every pricing decision or marketing practice. But the core enterprise of developing molecules that modulate specific biological pathways to treat disease? That's one of the greatest achievements of human civilization. It's added decades to life expectancy. It's turned previously fatal conditions into manageable chronic illnesses. HIV went from a death sentence to a condition you can live with indefinitely on a few pills a day. That's not a dystopian nightmare, that's a miracle.
Let's talk about the Israeli healthcare context specifically, because the prompt mentions it. The idea that even in a good system where medications are affordable, the unease persists.
Israel's health system is actually a fascinating case. The health basket, the Salbruta, covers a very comprehensive list of medications and services. Copays are low by international standards. Access is generally good. And yet the psychological resistance persists. That tells you something important. It's not primarily about money. The financial anxiety might be the origin story, but the resistance has become internalized. It's now about identity, about self-image, about deeply held beliefs about what it means to be healthy and autonomous.
Which means that simply making medications cheaper doesn't solve the adherence problem. You have to address the cultural narrative.
And this is where I think conversations like this one actually matter. Not to be grandiose about a podcast, but the act of articulating these internal narratives and examining them critically. That's part of how cultural change happens. If someone listens to this and recognizes their own resistance patterns and realizes those patterns are based on intuitions that don't hold up to scrutiny, that might actually change their behavior. Or at least open the door to a different conversation with themselves.
I think there's one more layer here that we haven't touched. The prompt describes a kind of layered resistance. It's not one objection, it's several, all pushing at once. Financial anxiety, cultural stoicism, fear of polypharmacy, the spontaneity concern, the administrative burden. And I think that's actually more honest than most discussions of medication adherence. People don't have one reason for resisting treatment. They have a coalition of reasons, and they reinforce each other.
That's a really important point, and it means that addressing just one objection isn't enough. You can explain that polypharmacy is safe, but if the person still feels guilty about the cost or still feels like taking pills erodes their spontaneity, they might still stop. The resistance is overdetermined. Multiple independent reasons, all pointing toward the same conclusion, don't take the pills.
Which means the counterargument also needs to be overdetermined. Multiple independent lines of evidence all pointing toward the same conclusion. Take the medications, they're keeping you alive and functional. The alternatives are worse.
And I think we've laid out several of those lines. The safety of appropriate polypharmacy. The evidence for combination therapy over monotherapy. The long-term consequences of untreated chronic conditions. The reframing of medications as pathway modulators rather than foreign chemicals. The critique of the naturalistic fallacy. The distinction between administrative burden and disease burden.
If someone's listening and recognizing themselves in this, the person who tries to taper off a medication without telling their doctor, or who feels guilty every time they fill a prescription, or who keeps wondering if they really need all these pills, what would you want them to do?
First, talk to your doctor, not with the goal of stopping medications, but with the goal of understanding them better. Ask, what is each medication actually doing? What would happen if I stopped it? What's the evidence that I need it? A good physician should be able to explain the rationale for each prescription. If they can't, or if they're dismissive, that's a problem. But most can and will. Second, consider the counterfactual honestly. Don't compare how you feel on medications to how you imagine you'd feel without them. Compare it to how you actually felt before you started them, or to the known outcomes of untreated disease. Third, recognize that the guilt and the resistance aren't coming from a rational place. They're emotional artifacts of your history and your culture. You don't have to act on them.
That last point feels crucial. You can feel the resistance and take the pills anyway. The feeling doesn't have to win.
You can acknowledge that part of you hates being dependent on medications, that part of you wishes you could just be spontaneous and unencumbered, that part of you feels guilty about the cost or the hassle, and still take the medications. Those feelings are real, but they're not injunctions. You don't have to obey them.
It's like, you can feel afraid of flying and still get on the plane. You can feel resistant to medications and still swallow the pills. The feeling and the action can coexist.
Over time, as the medications keep working and nothing terrible happens, the feelings often diminish. The resistance fades because it stops being reinforced by new evidence. Your brain eventually learns, oh, this is fine. This is just what I do now. It becomes routine rather than a daily existential crisis.
That's actually a hopeful note to end on. The resistance isn't permanent. It can be unlearned.
And the fact that someone is even examining their resistance, writing out their list of objections and asking for counter perspectives, that's already halfway there. The person who wrote that prompt is already doing the work.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the high medieval period, a quipu from the Chancay culture of pre-Columbian Peru was found to contain a knotted accounting record so precise that it tracked tribute payments of dried fish across three coastal valleys, with separate knot clusters distinguishing between mackerel and anchovies by species, weight, and delivery date. The document was essentially a 14th century fishery spreadsheet made entirely of string.
A fishery spreadsheet made of string. I'm going to think about that for a while.
Anchovy audit by knot density. Honestly, we've been bureaucrats forever.
This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps. Find more at My Weird Prompts. I'm Corn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Take your medications.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.